This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Joining us right now is Dr. William Moss. He's professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center, and of course, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Moss, on the phone from Baltimore. Bill, good to have you here with Katie and myself. Help us make sense as we try to figure out, should we be getting booster shots?
Yes, thank you very much for having me again. And I realize this has been a confusing issue for folks. And perhaps we should think about it, you know, who should get a booster and when should they get a booster? What we're really looking for, as you were just saying, we want our vaccines to protect us against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. That's our primary goal. And the way we're going to achieve this primarily is by getting more people vaccinated. Now, when and if we start seeing more breakthrough infections, or I should say higher rates of breakthrough infections in fully vaccinated individuals that results in severe disease, hospitalizations, and death, that's going to be our trigger for booster doses. And I think a lot of the discussion we're going to hear tomorrow at the FDA and then that next week with the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices are, do we have the data yet to suggest that there's increase in breakthrough infections resulting in severe disease? And I think where we may see this, we may see that there's evidence for older adults, perhaps those older than 65, but not yet for the general population.
Dr. Moss, I'm curious to hear your opinion on whether the FDA can really feel any public pressure, whether they feel pressure from the public to approve booster shots, because it feels like there is this sort of dichotomy emerging where, okay, the people who have been vaccinated, got vaccinated as soon as they were able to, they do want to get booster shots. And then you have, you know, the rest of the United States, the holdouts who haven't yet gotten their full vaccinations. I mean, does the FDA, would they even respond to that?
Yes, I think what we can expect from the FDA, and again, we'll hear about it tomorrow, is the FDA is going to tell us whether these additional doses for people who are fully vaccinated are safe and effective. That's what they're going to be looking for, and they have the data that were submitted by Pfizer. Some of that has been released in the FDA briefing that was released, and you know those numbers are based on relatively small sample sizes. But the FDA is going to be looking at that safety and effectiveness of an additional dose. What we have to wait for then is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that will make recommendations to the CDC on who should be, you know, on whether or not we should actually go forward with booster doses and who should be the recipients of those. They will not be weighing in on, you know, how do we deal with the problem of unvaccinated Americans at this point in the pandemic.
I guess what I wonder, too, is do you default and say, let me just go get a third one? I'd rather be safe than sorry. Or are there potential complications by getting a vaccine that you don't need?
Yeah. So, this is an important issue. The CDC estimates that perhaps at this point, 1.8 million Americans have gone ahead and got that booster dose.
Katie knows people who've done that.
I do. I know at least five.
Yes. And I can understand. And we're kind of, you know, feeling this tension between having a rigorous regulatory process and debate and in the midst of a pandemic and surging case numbers, surging hospitalizations and deaths in the United States, and people wanting to feel that they're best protected. And so individuals going out and getting those booster doses. We still don't know really whether there are any safety concerns around booster doses. I don't expect that we're going to have any surprises there. Pfizer did present to the FDA some of their safety data. Again, relatively small numbers, a couple hundred people. Maybe there was some increase in swollen lymph nodes after the third dose compared to the first two. But in general, the side effects seem to be the same. But again, small numbers. Where it also becomes problematic from a public health point of view is that it just makes it very hard for us to track the number of people vaccinated in the United States. If people are going and getting a third dose and kind of pretending they have never had a dose before, it messes up the numbers.
And so, Dr. Moss, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on some pushback that I've heard to booster shots, offering them in the United States, because you have the developed world where, you know, a lot of people who want to be vaccinated have gotten vaccinated. And then you have, you know, the emerging markets of the world where it's been a really tough rollout and, you know, a lot of people still remain unvaccinated. So some of the pushback I hear is that, you know, offering booster shots will basically exacerbate global inequality. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Right. It's a very important issue. We've heard from the World Health Organization and the Director General there raising this issue. There was a recent report in The Lancet raising this issue as well, about the ethics of booster doses in high-income countries when much of the world remains unvaccinated. There's no doubt there remain glaring global inequities in vaccination coverage. 80% or more of vaccine doses have been administered to people in high and upper middle income countries. Less than 0.5% have gone to people in low income countries. And as many folks have said, you know, we're not going to be able to control this pandemic in the United States until it's controlled globally. The question is, you know, can these doses that are now sitting, you know, in the United States, you know, be diverted or rechanneled to other countries? There's no doubt that the United States can and should do more to address those global inequities. But also, if a vaccine's out at a pharmacy, you know, there's no way we're going to get that reroute that vaccine dose. So this is a very important issue. But it's also very complex in terms of the process of how we take vaccines in the United States and get them to other countries where perhaps they're needed more.
Yeah, I feel like this is an issue we've been talking about from day one when we knew a vaccine would hopefully ultimately be created. How do we make sure that it gets out to the world? Having said that, Dr. Moss, I think one of the discussions I keep hearing a lot in the U.S. right now is get ready for flu season, everyone, because you're all going to get really sick and you need to get a flu shot too. What's your advice to our listeners right now who are thinking, I'm going to need to get a COVID-19 booster, I'm going to need to get a flu shot? How do we need to kind of schedule all this, plan for this?
Yes, well, you know, these vaccines are very important in our public health response and protecting ourselves individually and protecting people around us. Our COVID-19 vaccines are actually much better than our influenza vaccines, but it's going to be very important with this upcoming respiratory season that people get vaccinated against, be vaccinated against COVID-19 and get their annual flu shot. What we don't want to have happen, and I think one of the real tragedies of this last wave of cases in the United States is that we've allowed our healthcare system, our hospitals, our intensive care units to be overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients to the point where sometimes people with other diseases can't get the care they need. Mm-hmm. What we don't have happen this respiratory season is to see our healthcare system overwhelmed again with both COVID and influenza cases.
Right. We're seeing parts of the country already, right, that are overwhelmed because of COVID.
Absolutely. And I mean, Dr. Moss, I'd love to get your thoughts on children and vaccinating children because school is opening back up. New York City public schools just had their first day. When will we see the bottom end of the range for who can get vaccinated? basically increase? I'm missing metaphors there, but when will children younger than 12 be able to get vaccines?
Yes, this is a very common question, and I wish I had a definitive answer on this, but what I can tell you is that this will be done in phases. The first group of children for whom we'll see an authorization or approval are children 5 years to 11 years of age. It will be with the Pfizer vaccine. They're slightly ahead of Moderna in having the data being collected and presented to the FDA. We expect Pfizer to be able to present these data on that age group perhaps by the end of September or early October. It'll then take a couple weeks for FDA to review the data, and then we'll need a recommendation from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices should the vaccine be deemed safe and effective in that age group. And again, I don't expect any surprises there. So I'm hopeful that we'll have an approval or authorization perhaps late October, early November, depending upon how the process goes. But we won't see a vaccine for children younger than 5 years of age until first quarter of 2022.
On some level, you got to appreciate the measured and careful guidance by regulators on all of this as we move forward, and always appreciate the guidance of Dr. William Moss, Executive Director of the International Vaccine Access Center, Professor in the Departments of Epidemiology, International Health, and Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Remember how we keep talking about the push for a $15 federal minimum wage? We do that. Well, the move may have stalled in Congress, but thanks to our current environment, we may already be there. So let's get to it. Here to explain, Bloomberg News economy reporter Michael Sasso. He joins us on the phone in our Atlanta bureau. Mike, good to have you here with Katie and myself. So tell us what's going on.
Yeah, good to be here. You know, what we've seen is just kind of a topsy-turvy labor market where even though the move to adopt a $15 minimum wage may have stalled in Congress, it seems that the market, as well as, let's just be honest, there's a lot of state and local minimum wage laws going into effect. So those two things combined are, you know, making it so that a relatively small portion of Americans makes less than 15 hours as we speak.
Yeah. I was amazed that I forgot that the minimum wage still, though, for a lot of Americans is $7.25 an hour.
Yeah. What is it? I forget what the stat is. I believe it's at least a decade old. So
yeah.
I have not kept up at all with the rate of inflation. And
yeah.
there are 10 states that have adopted a $15 mm-hmm. minimum wage, not immediately, but kind of ramp up to $15. So they're kind of getting ahead of the curve.
And so, Mike, your characterization of the labor market, topsy-turvy, it definitely feels accurate just, you know, after sitting through the NFP release every month. So it feels like we're in this interesting scenario where part of the reason the, you know, wages are rising is because employers can't fill their roles. You had a great stat in your article that the number of job vacancies exceeded new hires by 4.3 million in July. I'm curious, even with the higher wages, why aren't employees necessarily coming back into the workforce?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. You know, certainly there has been a lot of women have stayed out of the workforce for child care issues. You know, there's the old question about whether the enhanced unemployment benefits were keeping people out of the labor force. Of course, those are expired now, but there's, I got to tell you, a lot. Every employer I talk to insists that yes, those high unemployment benefits were keeping people out. Even though most economists and a lot of these academics will say there's no evidence of that. So that is a big a big question.
Yeah, I was talking to senior execs, people who've been in the airline industry for a long time over the past week. And what's interesting is they're saying people just don't want to come back to work. They just don't want to come back to work. And this includes things like flight attendants and you name it. And we're seeing that play out. So what does this mean? Okay, because it's a tight labor force, Mike, And so that is forcing employers like a Walmart, like a Target, like a Chipotle Mexican Grill to bump up their average hourly pay to $15 or more. Amazon, what, you know, looking for some of their logistics jobs, $18 an hour. So we're kind of getting that $15 an hour minimum wage. What does it mean in terms of cost to employers? What does it mean in terms of versus inflation, real wages? What does it all mean?
Well, yeah, that's the issue. The inflation piece is interesting. So it's not as if everyone is doing at some of these lower paid jobs is just experiencing this absolute windfall. You know, inflation is running a little over 5%. So to be sure, and over the last now, to be sure, since the pandemic started, wage inflation has advanced more so. Wage inflation or wages are rising at a greater pace than inflation is. So that's a good thing for the worker. In the last year, however, that's actually reversed itself, and inflation is actually eating up a greater percentage of wages. And so since the pandemic started, you know, things have generally on the upswing, although there's been a blip over the last year, just the last year, because of just the cost of everything rising.
All right. So just 30 seconds. So does this mean, thanks, you know, we don't need the federal government to get there, that we're going to now see the new floor of $15 that stays with us longer term, just quickly?
Well, there's probably some people would say that. I will say activists are having none of that. They're insisting, as somebody told me, $15 is not the, you know, the cap. That's $15 is the floor, and we intend to go higher than that.
Yeah, it's a very different economy that we're certainly seeing come out of this pandemic, and we're not quite there out of the pandemic. Mike Sasso, thank you so much. He is economy reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Atlanta. You do wonder, too, Katie, though, these are, you know, higher wages, higher labor costs for companies. You know, how much do they ultimately pass along to consumers? I guess that's something we'll keep an eye on.
Absolutely. I mean, this is how inflation gets built into the economy, when you actually see employers raise wages.
Exactly. Good point. And then add the supply chain problems and, yeah, costs go up.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a Bloomberg exclusive. It's also the Bloomberg Business Week cover story. It's about Peter Thiel, you know, the Silicon Valley billionaire investor and disruptor. Turns out he's kind of just like all the other rich folks out there. So writes Max Chafkin in his new biography of Thiel. Let's get more on this. Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber, as I just mentioned, in our Bloomberg Interactive studio, along with Bloomberg U.S. Technology Managing Editor Mark Millian. He is on the phone in our New York City bureau. Peter Thiel, we've talked about him a lot and his relationship. Interesting one with Trump.
Yeah, and I'm gonna actually say that he's not maybe like all the other rich people you know. And that, I think that
except when it comes to taxes.
And he's never had a biography of him before, and that is first and foremost the feat that our own colleague Max Chafkin has accomplished with this book, The Contrarian, out next week. It's really fascinating. You mentioned the Trump thing. That is where the excerpt that is the cover story this week begins. This meeting in Trump Tower right in the transition period after Trump had been elected, where Peter Thiel, who you may recall was on the stage at the Republican National Convention just a couple weeks before that, months before that, and basically he was able to bring a bunch of tech CEOs to Trump and basically be this bridge between tech and the recently elected president in a way that was somewhat unexpected, right?
Right.
And it speaks to the sort of the power that Thiel wields in Silicon Valley. Like, obviously, he's been real integral part of this PayPal mafia for years, first outside investor in Facebook. And there's a lot of roads in Silicon Valley that lead to Peter Thiel. And what's interesting was this sort of little marriage that happened between Trump and Thiel. And that proved not great for a lot of people in Trump's circle. And it seemed to have worked out really well for Peter Thiel, who we think more than doubled his fortune during that time.
Mark, I want to bring you into this conversation because what's been really wonderful throughout the Trump presidency and thereafter is, you know, exploring these relationships that the former president had with some likely subjects and some unlikely subjects. And Peter Thiel seems to fall into that category.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. And one of the
despite holding hands at that meeting at Trump Tower.
That is a stark image, the bro hand-holding love fest they had there. But Thiel is a longtime technologist from Silicon Valley, foreign-born, gay. I mean, there are a lot of things about his background that would suggest that he would not be part of the MAGA contingent. And yet he is a contrarian investor above all else, and he's made a lot of bad bets over the years, but he's made some fantastic ones. Facebook is certainly in that camp, and I think Trump is in that camp.
Yeah, Mark, that's what I want to dig into because, I mean, like you said, this is what Thiel does. I mean, he's a venture capitalist. His whole thing is finding, you know, startups to invest in. I mean, how much does this, is there a parallel to draw between his MO when it comes to, you know, investing, being a venture capitalist, and this kind of unlikely relationship he forged with Donald Trump?
I think there's a direct line. I think his entire investment strategy is a reflection of the title of Max's book, which is contrarian. I mean, he looks at where the popular opinions are and where the winds are blowing, and he goes the opposite direction. And oftentimes that doesn't work. Max chronicles in the book his hedge fund Clarium Capital, which was like very early to seeing the housing crisis, but in fact was too early and just went so far down this contrarian path that it led to disaster. And so this strategy is not foolproof, but when you nail it, I mean, it can really pay off. And I think Trump was an example of where he saw it early and he went in pretty big, and it did pay off in some ways.
Speaking of paying off, the ultimate payoff has been the Roth IRA. And and that is to your joke earlier, just about, you know, just like other billionaires. We don't really know if other billionaires have done this as well as Peter Thiel has, but it seems to be that he has exploited the Roth IRA to perhaps a way that was never intended. You know, this was invented as really like a way to help middle-class Americans retire, and he seems to have been able to pack away some shares from PayPal and Palantir and others, perhaps, all tax-free, and then watch that grow. And so Max reporting suggests north of $5 billion, all tax-free.
Just like my Roth IRA.
could some reporting suggest maybe closer to $10 billion?
That's a lot.
And it's also, as Max reveals in this excerpt in his book, it's also the thing that's made him quite paranoid, that it would not take that much for the IRS to maybe change, you know, have these rules changed. It would take more than the IRS. But the IRS seems to be keeping a pretty close eye to make sure everything is abided by and is very textbook. And otherwise, you know, the risk there would be that, you know, you could have a pretty sizable tax bill in the billions.
And Mark, I mean, it's legal, right?
It's all legal. And actually, you know, Max's reporting indicates that, you know, there was an audit. And so it has been looked at closely. And he is not alone, right? Like this is something, and there's an unrelated story today even by Bloomberg News that, you know, there is a small group of people who seem to have been able to work these IRAs to great results.
Ben Steverman's story. We're going to talk to him a little bit later on. I mean, Matt, as you go through, you know, Max's book and this excerpt, which is the cover story, again, like you say, that picture of the two of them holding hands. I mean, I think for a long time early on, we were all just trying to make sense of this relationship. But in the end, Peter Thiel benefited big time.
Yes, he certainly did. I mean, not to the extent maybe he envisioned in his wildest imaginations of sort of remaking government in his image. You know, Max, this excerpt goes into some detail about how he offered, you know, a long list of picks for various administrative positions that the campaign deemed too extreme.
Which is something.
Yeah. Really says something for sure.
But, you know, the other thing that I think is important, and this is sort of the, where Max's excerpt culminates, and I think it's one of the reasons that, this biography by Max Shefkin, as I mentioned, out next week, is so important, is that what we're really going to be watching here is Peter Thiel's a transition from being a Silicon Valley power broker to something that maybe is more about the GOP and politics going forward. And that will play out in midterms first and foremost.
Really good point. This story cover on the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which is available. Bloomberg Business Week, of course, and that's Max Chafkin's book, The Contrarian. We're going to be talking to Max next week. Joel and Mark, thanks.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. From Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Katie Greifeld. She's in for Tim Stenovic. Kind of heard a bunch of people go into space, another group.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just this steady stream.
Not Tim. That's not where he
not
is.
Not Tim. It's not Ed Ludlow either, although I think both of them would love to.
I think so, too. I would. Wouldn't you?
No. Oh, you have to pay me to get into a rocket ship. No way. I just told you I was afraid of boats.
You won't even go to the dentist. I'm just going to put it out there.
Of course. Yeah.
All right. We'll talk about that later. It did happen, though, at 8 p.m. local time yesterday from Kennedy Space Center in Florida. SpaceX sending 4 civilians on a 3-day orbital excursion. Who was there was Bloomberg News West Coast correspondent Ed Ludlow. He joins us from Cape Canaveral in Florida. So good to have you here. I would go up. I know you would go up. Tell us about what it's been like.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, it's been tense because of the nature of what we're talking about. These are 4 civilians. They're not professional astronauts. And even though SpaceX has a fantastic track record, they've done so many missions now ferrying professional astronauts to and from the International Space Station. This mission is so ambitious. They're currently orbiting the Earth at 360 miles altitude, you know, much further than the International Space Station, much further than the Hubble telescope. And, you know, the question going into this was, why would they do that? Why would they not just play it safe? But the latest reports we have from SpaceX is the crew's doing well. They've even slept and had meals and things like that. So far, it's a successful mission.
And so, Ed, I'm really curious to hear what this means for commercial space travel and whether that's becoming closer to becoming a reality. You know, when will Ed Ludlow be able to get into orbit?
Yeah, look, SpaceX talks about this side of the business being supply constrained, right? That there's really great demand there and it outweighs their ability or the number of times that they can launch in a calendar year. They're talking about sort of potentially 4 missions in 2022, which is still quite a lot, you know, going from 0 to 4. I think the big takeaway from the investors I speak to, you know, people that work at NASA, aerospace engineers, is this mission is so much more of a big deal than what we saw from Bezos and Branson. You know, what they did doesn't even register. Bezos went to 65 miles above the Earth for a few minutes. These guys are orbiting the Earth for 3 days as amateurs, as civilians, with minimal training, encountering higher radiation, space debris, all aboard a fully autonomous system. And if they're successful, the consensus is this really is a big step forward for human spaceflight in general.
And as you said, minimal preparation, but nonetheless, these 4 spent, according to your reporting, about 9 months in preparation. They had to learn how to intervene during the flight if necessary. I mean, this isn't just take a seat, you're up for a few seconds, basically, and then you're back down on Earth.
Correct. So it's a fully autonomous spaceship. However, you know, things happen. And this is what's so amazing. Their entire experience was documented by Netflix, right? So if the listeners go onto Netflix, you can watch the first 4 parts of the series, which includes their training, you know, things you'd expect like centrifuges and extreme G-force exposure. And Jared Isaacman, who is actually paying for this entire thing and the commander of the mission, one of the 4 inside the capsule, his day job is running a fintech company. His passion is being a pilot. And he took all of them on fighter jets to experience that extreme G-force. So they did do this properly, and they are ready in the event that they have to act.
And so I know that they went through all that prep. It still blows my mind that there's no professional astronauts on this trip. But Ed, so, I mean, this is different, like we've just been talking about, different from Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, which sort of took off and then came back down pretty quickly. This flight is actually going into orbit. And I feel like, you know, at least I've been joking about the billionaire space race for months now, but I'm curious whether we should expect a response from Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson.
Well, we just got it.
Oh, yeah?
He tweeted it within the last hour, and all he said was congratulations, as did Richard Branson. And Elon Musk replied saying thank you to both of them. You know, like, this has been the criticism, right, that this is a billionaire's sport and that it's only open to billionaires. And Jared Isaacman himself is a billionaire. He's paying the reported $200 million for these guys to be up there. But he acknowledged it head on, and he basically said, I am bringing exposure to this industry. I'm showing that it is possible. And that more investment is needed, and that it is possible and attainable for a civilian to eventually go up. And he kind of went on with that. And that's why they're at 360 miles and not playing it safe, because he wanted to show that you could actually make progress and develop the science, develop the technology in that process.
Well, and it's interesting, too, and you point out, too, in your story that's on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com about how the mission's raising about $200 million in charity for childhood cancer research. So there's another component to this story. The thing is, you know, Ed, the debate. There are people who are saying, why are we spending, why are companies spending so much money on this? You know, what do we get out of it? But I'm a daughter of a, I say this all the time, I know my producers are like, here she goes again, but a daughter of an engineer, electrical aerospace engineer who worked on the early space missions. A lot of what we learned from those missions led to some pretty significant scientific and technological developments. Jeff Bezos says, right, he wants to learn more about space to help Earth. All of this could ultimately lead to some really important discoveries.
That is the logic here. Very quickly on St. Jude and cancer. I mean, this mission is so high profile. The world's media were there, and they're going to raise $200 million. Haley Arsenault, one of the people on the capsule in space, is a cancer survivor and now works at St. Jude. So that's the link there. One thing I learned in my reporting is SpaceX has agreed to give NASA all of the data generated from this mission for free at no cost. And it's really detailed data, things like radiation, as I said, space debris, the tests they're doing on board are about the human body. And after they land, if they land successfully back, splash down on the Florida coast, then SpaceX is even going to hand over the capsule and let NASA inspect it. So this is all worthwhile as part of a bigger, broader initiative to move forward with human spaceflight.
Just got to make it a little bit more affordable. I can't exactly put this on my charge card.
You've got a supply crunch, you know? Yeah, exactly. It's everywhere.
Supply crunch everywhere. Ed Ludlow, safe travels. You got to get back to Katie so you guys can anchor tomorrow on Bloomberg Quick Take together. Ed Ludlow, West Coast correspondent, Bloomberg News, on the phone, actually at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Still, you don't want to go?
No, I'm not there yet, but happy to watch other people do it.
All right. Well, my guess is we're going to continue to see the billionaires and others going up into space.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. We are, as Charlie mentioned, well off our lows of the session. Slight gain, in fact, on the NASDAQ as we speak. Let's get to it. The Drive to the Close. Our guest today is Chris Dyer, Director of Global Equity over at Eaton Vance, with us on the phone in London. Chris, nice to have you here with Katie and myself. You look at the market, you look at the trade today, September. Not a great month, although when you really look at the percentages, at least for the U.S. trade, we're just down by maybe a percentage point or so, especially when it comes to the large cap names. How do you see the market environment? And feel free to expand it in terms of the global environment.
Sure, and thanks for having me. I think what we've seen in the market over the last couple of weeks is really emblematic of the broader challenge with the equity market. I think the equity market is becoming increasingly difficult to navigate from a pure top-down perspective, as it had been over the last several years. If you think back a few years ago, you know, it was really growth and momentum was driving the market. And then earlier, late 2020 and then early 2021, the reopening trade really shifted rotation into cyclicals and value stocks, and that's played out now. And so I think the market is really trying to find a direction, and there's a lot of tug of war going on between factors that should drive the market potentially higher, but also some challenges and concerns that are facing the market. And so I think that the bottom line from our perspective is that you really need to focus on stock selection. There needs to be some good bottom-up stock-specific stories to drive returns, which is a great market environment for active managers.
Well, let's talk about that, Chris. I mean, when it comes to individual stocks, what are you keeping an eye on?
A mix of different companies. And again, I'll highlight some European names because Europe has been out of focus for U.S. investors for many years. And we are firm believers that, the outperformance going forward in the coming years should be driven by Europe. It's time for a geographical rotation. And so a few of the names that, I would highlight should be relatively familiar. Stellantis, that's the company that it's an auto manufacturer that was created through the merger of Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot. They came together earlier this year, and there's just a tremendous amount of synergies that are going to be delivered by the CEO, Carlos Tavares, who we have a lot of respect for, and he's got a great long-term track record. And, this is a company that trades on a mid-single-digit price-to-earnings multiple. And so there's a real value aspect to this company. And, there's a stock-specific story, a real improvement story to come through. And then on the other side of the equation, a company like Novo Nordisk, which is a Danish pharmaceuticals company. They're the global leader in what they do, which is they basically have leading diabetes drugs, which has unfortunately been a growing market across the globe. But now what's interesting and, the next leg of growth for them in years to come is the release of a new obesity drug, which is called Wegovy. And if you just think about the market opportunity for an obesity drug, estimates are that in 2025, across the globe, there could be 1 billion obese people.
Let me just ask you, Chris, both of those names, if I look at the ADRs, I'm thinking of our audience that might be listening here in the U.S. It looks like both of those ADRs have been on a tear this year. Stellantis is up almost 41%. Novo Nordisk is up almost 47%. Still opportunity, though, you think, for upside momentum.
That's right. And in each of those cases, there is something that we think will be a catalyst for further share price moves in the years to come. We are long-term investors, and these are companies that we believe, will continue to do well in years to come. They're very different, however, and that sort of goes back to what I said earlier. It's not going to be one top-down factor that's driving the market. So Stellantis is very much a value stock. Novo Nordisk is a growth pharmaceutical company. It trades on a much higher price-to-earnings multiple, but they have a new drug that we believe will catalyze growth for them in years to come, given the results that they're having and the efficacy of the drug.
Just to jump in, though, you did say not one top-down factor impacting these names. Having said that, we've had one top-down, bottom-down, or bottom-up factor, and that's been COVID. How does that factor into your thinking? I understand the approach of bottoms-up analysis, but COVID is still out there. So does that play into any of your thinking about some of these names?
I think that there will, for many companies, there will be disruption in the short term. Okay. If you think of a pharmaceutical company, not so much from that perspective. But within the auto space, we typically have avoided investing in OEMs. If you look at the environment and the challenges that are facing the auto sector in terms of a shortage of semiconductor stocks really impacting the ability of the companies to meet demand, that is a short-term disruption. And part of that is related to COVID because of the availability of right. workers, particularly in semiconductor plants in Malaysia. So there will be continuing to be disruption in the short term. But, again, we believe that investors should really focus on companies with good long-term stories that are not going to be too dependent on just factor investing.
Yeah, and Chris, it was interesting to hear you run through your picks. And like you noted, I mean, you have some growth names in there, you have some value names. And, you just said that, when it comes to factors, not really relying on that. But what is the common denominator, if there is one, between some of those individual picks?
And just got about 40 seconds.
Sure. Sustainable business models. Yeah, that is what we look for in the Calvert International Equity Strategy in which we're managing. Look for companies that we have a good feel for what they're going to look like in decades to come and have a good understanding of what earnings and growth opportunities are there for them.
That's some sound advice. I like that. Sustainable business models. Hey, Chris, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Chris Dyer, he's Director of Global Equity over at Eaton Vance, joining us on the phone from London. You know, the bottoms-up approach. We hear that from a lot of folks that, you know, if you look at particular names, if you understand their business, understand maybe their growth trajectory, that's how you can make an investment decision.
Yeah, and there's probably a lot of active managers, to Chris's point, that are listening to that and saying, bring it on. Let's go.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.